From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Let's just jump in. There's plenty going on, and it's been a while, so take it away.
Well, and obviously the main story for most people of progressive views is what's happening in Venezuela.
Yeah.
But I think, as we look at the detail of the developing U.S. attack against Venezuela, and it increasingly seems to bear out what you and I were talking about in a previous couple of programs. We haven't spoken for some time now, but in our previous conversations, we were talking about how unlikely it is that the United States is going to get any kind of clean cut victory from their point of view in Venezuela in terms of regime change. And that's been borne out by the events of the last couple of months. And as the attacks, as the resistance and the resilience of President Nicolas Maduro's government becomes clearer and clearer to people observing what's going on, the United States authorities get, and in particular, of course, Elliot Abrams and John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, become more and more desperate because their utterances and declarations of the previous two or three months are looking more and more stupid with every day that goes by.
They're like completely removed from reality. It's like there's a virtual presidency there for this guy. It's not connected to the people. He can't collect more than 100 or 200 people in a rally at this point inside Venezuela. The biggest challenge now, it appears, is for the Venezuelan security forces to protect him from Venezuelan people, because they're angry at him, and so their job is to protect him from what he's earned, basically. And meanwhile, his wife, who she's pretty young, so I thought she looked like maybe his daughter, is in Washington. The papers here are treating her as the First Lady of Venezuela.
Yeah.
And again, there's no... I don't think she could park her car and not worry about getting ticketed in downtown Caracas just as an average citizen.
Sure. No, I think you're referring to an incident in which the Venezuelan police protected Juan Guaido from irate citizens who...
Yeah.
And Max Blumenthal, the reporter from the Gray Zone, who did a great job here in Nicaragua last year, he's doing a similarly very important job in Venezuela. He did a report that appeared on RT, and you may well have seen it, saying, what kind of dictatorship is it whose police protect the opposition trying to overthrow the government?
Right, I know.
But that goes to something fundamental it runs parallel to, while we're talking about the reality of the events here in Latin America, in the United States, people are completely deceived by wall-to-wall false propaganda. And you correctly pointed out the U.S. media treating Juan Guaido's wife as if she were the First Lady of Venezuela, and she gets to meet President Trump, etc., etc., as if that's any kind of honor. But the thing is that that is what people in the United States perceive. That is their daily news.
Right.
And here in Nicaragua, we had that all last year. I still have to deal with people that I know in the United States who think that we're in some kind of dictatorship here in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Completely absurd.
Well, remember in Venezuela, right after the National Assembly elections in December of 2015, the Capriles, I think, who was the leader of the opposition at the time, one of the leaders, Lopez, one of them, was basically saying, okay, now that we've won a majority in the National Assembly, we're going to step up and run this dictator out of town. It's like, you mean right after you guys got elected as opposition to the government, you're looking at the government as a dictator? You're calling the government a dictator still? What the hell is that?
It is completely insane. And it's like anybody who's ever dealt with people or relatives suffering from dementia, that is what it is like trying to talk to people in the United States about Latin America, because they have completely demented ideas about the reality in the region.
Yep.
And we can continue to harp on that, but it probably makes more sense to explain the nitty-gritty of that by looking at from one country to the next at what's going on. So in Venezuela, you have a government that has mass support, and despite everything, despite the continuing attacks, despite the disruption and sabotage of the electricity system by the United States and its cyber warfare units, and despite the direct sabotage by paramilitaries that have been infiltrated into the country from Colombia, despite all that, the government of Nicolas Maduro is still carrying on, and they're meeting the needs of the people in a way that most governments in Latin America are not doing.
Right.
Meeting the social, despite everything, and so let's look, for example, at Argentina. Argentina is in complete meltdown economically, and they've got poverty now is supposed to be around 32% in Argentina, right? This is a member of the OECD.
Right.
It's a member of the G20. It's one of the wealthiest countries in the South.
Right.
And there they are. They've got 32% poverty. What on earth is? Why is that not being reported?
Right.
And they have an economic crisis as a direct result of Mauricio Macri's ridiculous neoliberal economic policies, backed to the hilt by the International Monetary Fund, of course.
Right.
And so there you have Argentina in social and economic meltdown, but that's not making the news anyway.
I mean, what really ought to make the news is the fact that this occurred. This is a change that's taken place in the last 3 years. In other words, you could map a huge increase, a crisis increase in poverty in Argentina from December of 2015, when Macri was elected and instituted these policies. That is certainly newsworthy. It's not like some long, slowly evolving story, but rather the kind of thing that should be on the front page.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is that Macri's government is irredeemably corrupt, and that is the worst aspects of that are now coming out, where you have a Macri supporter, very clearly a supporter of the Macri government. He's involved in the justice system. I think he's an investigating judge. Caught up in very serious extortion charges, right? Mm-hmm. There's very little focus on that, if any focus at all, in Western, certainly corporate media or alternative media either, and that so what gets reported are the charges against the ridiculous charges against Cristina Kirchner, but you don't actually this is the flip side, if you like, of the demented news coverage that people get of Latin America in the United States, whereby every progressive leader is a dictator. And anything that it looks makes a right wing government like Mauricio Macri's look bad gets suppressed. So that's the situation in Argentina. And look at what's happening in Brazil. In Brazil, you've got a president who is now trying to celebrate the military coup of 1964.
Right.
And the justice system in Brazil, to their credit, issued a judgment that it would be illegal for him to celebrate that anniversary, which is what he wanted to do. I think he went ahead and did it anyway.
Right.
And there are unlikely to be any consequences about that. But what that means is that in a very real sense, the United States is promoting a return to the 1970s dictatorships, and the not then they don't have the form of dictatorships that come to power via military coup, because it's all a little more subtle now. But as we can see in Venezuela and also in Nicaragua and the rhetoric against Cuba, and the subtlety is very is only a veneer. Underneath, the ideological drive and towards repression, and the denial of democracy and the denial of fundamental rights for the great majority of people in Latin America, that is still the same as it ever was.
It's actually worse in a way than an actual military coup, because in the case of an actual military coup, there is usually some back and forth between the population and the military where the people resist. Here, what you're doing, in fact, is creating consent for the conditions, in other words, an affirmation of a military coup as a valid way of achieving policy that and putting the people on, you know, more or less on game with that policy. You create manufacturing consent.
Yeah, and I think we still have, I think the jury's out on how far Bolsonaro has any real popular support, in the same way that,
right.
Because he cheated people, he defrauded people with his election campaign.
And Lula was in jail, by the way. Lula couldn't run. The most popular guy couldn't run either.
Correct. And so if you look at what the mobilization that's going on in Brazil, and it's taking some time to get momentum and get force, certainly the force necessary to pose a serious challenge to the Bolsonaro government in policy terms, in terms of resisting what Bolsonaro is trying to do, and privatize everything, cut back social services and social provision in education and healthcare. And
right.
people in Brazil are waking up to that, and I think we're likely to see over the next year, 18 months, a strongly resurgent popular movement. But and the staying with where we are right now, and if you look at what's happening in somewhere like Uruguay, for example, Uruguay is a tiny country of what, 3-4 million people, but and it was a kind of a very much an archetype of what a military dictatorship was like back in the 1970s. It was, you could see it in that very reduced space that is Uruguay, the meaning and the significance of a military dictatorship in economic terms, in social terms, in personal and moral terms was perhaps clearer even than it was in a larger country like Argentina. Now you have in Uruguay, you've had I think it's a former head of the armed forces trying to defend the dictatorship, and the president there, Tabaré Vázquez, has now felt obliged to to dismiss his minister of defense and his the subsecretary for defense and also the heads of the armed forces, because an internal military tribunal refused to bring measures against somebody who confessed to a heinous murder back in the days of the dictatorship. So, and what does that mean? That means that in Uruguay, and you can extrapolate from Uruguay to the broader southern cone, to Chile, to Argentina, and also to Brazil, of course, what that means is that the military don't care. They think that they're immune. They think, you know, these extreme fascists who are responsible for terrible crimes all through the 70s and the early 80s, they just don't care about public opinion or possible judicial consequences. Where does that come from? That comes from deliberate United States policy to promote a fascist. Let's call it what it is. I mean, this is a fascist agenda, the marriage of corporate power to political power,
right,
backed up by the military. That's what it is.
Yep.
And so you can see that very clearly in Uruguay. It's there, kind of latent in Argentina. It's less latent in Chile, right? And so that is a motif, a continental-wide motif, that we will see become clearer and clearer, in particular over the next year or so, as the United States policy in the region fails. They think that they've done quite well by co-opting governments in Argentina and Brazil, in particular. But As I said earlier, I think what we're likely to see over the next year or 18 months is a very strong resurgence of popular resistance to that. And the question then is the question that you and I asked ourselves back in late 2015 after Mauricio Macri's victory. And what is in the elections that year in Argentina, how are they going to maintain their political control once their economic policies smash into the wreck that we're seeing develop right now?
Right. I mean, and that's exactly the look. We pointed out then, we were looking backwards to how they had gotten there in the first place. You had the crisis in Argentina that led directly to Kirchner and then Cristina da Silva de Kirchner. You had essentially the same condition in Brazil, where you had the fascists and the neoliberal economics that led to a collapse that led essentially to Lula and to Dilma Rousseff. In other words, you had the failure of right-wing governments with neoliberal economics that led to an uprising by the left. And again, the same in Venezuela. And all of these things are happening like in the 1990s, really, and coming into this century. And you had the construction for 10 to 20 to 25 years of infrastructure in the half of the population that had been left out of the development of the country for its entire history up to that point, building a constituency where you end up with the demographics in Brazil and Venezuela and Argentina, perhaps by somewhat different path, and even in Chile, where the population is evenly divided on the question of a left or a right-wing path. And right. The ground has been washing out under the feet of those who favored a right-wing path, because inevitably it does, because their program is to impose the old program that led directly to the left-wing resurgence.
Yeah, you can see that very much in Ecuador, can't you?
And
the recent elections, the sectional elections and the municipal elections in
quick
Ecuador.
There, yeah.
And the collapse of support for Lenin Moreno,
yep.
and the resurgence of support for political movements that support former President Rafael Correa. And Ecuador is very much a case. And right now in Ecuador, you can see very clearly what I suggested is likely to happen over the next 12, 18 months. There's a very clear resurgence of grassroots opinion against what Lenin Moreno and his U.S. masters have tried to impose on Ecuador under the false pretenses of, you know, neoliberal policies will bring you prosperity. Only complete idiots believe that.
Right.
They managed to fool enough people in Argentina and elsewhere to believe that nonsense. And now you can see very clearly in Ecuador that political project is falling to bits before our very eyes. Now, so then one fundamental thing is, you know, if it is the regional right wing capable of reaching an agreement that they'll abide by. So, and if you look at events in Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, Uruguay, all these places, the question is, will they play by the rules of the game, which the electoral game that up until the victory of Hugo Chavez, for example, in 1998, the United States had been able to dominate, and then with the election of people like Hugo Chavez over Morales in Bolivia and other progressive leaders, Nestor Kirchner in Argentina, Lula da Silva in Brazil, with that wave of progressive political leaders winning the electoral game by the rules that had been imposed on the region by the United States, you know, supposedly championing democracy.
Right.
And the United States thought that the elites in the United States thought that they had things sewn up in the 1990s.
Right.
And in the early, and through the 2000s, they were shown to be completely wrong. And now the question is, will the right, that I perceive anyway, it's a fundamental question, is is the right wing willing to play by those old rules and lose again?
Right. Right. In other words, if they lose the election, will they walk out of the office?
Well, yeah. And so and the answer to that is, you can see in Colombia, for example, and what is it that the Russians say about the United States? I mean, something like they're non-agreement capable. Isn't that it?
So
we're seeing that absolutely borne out among U.S. allies in the region. For example, in Colombia, Iván Duque and his associates dominated by former President Álvaro Uribe, who's a narco-terrorist gangster, and they're the people that control Colombia at the moment. They're trying to roll back the peace agreement that was negotiated between Juan Manuel Santos and the former FARC guerrilla. Now, there's a strong movement in Colombia to try and defend the peace agreement, but then what does that mean in regional terms? It means that the regional right wing in Colombia, and you see it also in Venezuela, you see it also in Nicaragua, you can see it in Bolivia, although it's not quite as blatant in Bolivia perhaps as certainly in Venezuela, the right wing are not agreement capable. They are incapable of signing an agreement and then abiding by the terms of that agreement. So in Colombia, they signed up to the peace process. They've already made some changes to it, and now they're trying to roll it back completely. That's what's going on in Colombia. In Venezuela, and we all know what happened back in last year at the beginning of what was it, 2018.
Yeah.
They were on the point of signing an enduring political settlement in the Dominican Republic, and Rex Tillerson rang up the Venezuelan opposition negotiating team and told them not to sign. And they abruptly, on the day that they'd said that they were going to turn up and sign, they turned around and walked away.
Yep.
And you can see that across the region. Here in Nicaragua, the Nicaraguan authorities are desperate to try and maintain economic and social stability. But the United States authorities, and Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, Elliot Abrams has input, but also people like Marco Rubio, who seems to be the unofficial Secretary of State as far as Latin America is concerned. Mm-hmm. And they are putting pressure on the opposition here not to sign an agreement. So over the last month or so, the Nicaraguan opposition have been in talks with the government. They came to very specific agreements to do with releasing people, not completely in setting them free, but at least getting them out of jail and perhaps under house arrest or with a suspension of their prison sentence or some such legal figure to get them to get them out of jail, and that which is very controversial here for the majority of people in Nicaragua, who just detest the Nicaraguan opposition for the disgraceful behavior, the death and destruction, the death of around 300 people last year, and destruction to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars to public infrastructure.
Well, and their memory of the 80s, by the way.
Well, yeah. So so what? But what happens? You what has just happened over the last week? And the opposition here signed up to an agreement. They actually signed an agreement. Right. And now they're turning around and saying, right. Oh, well, we didn't mean that. We have extra demands.
Right.
Where does that come from? And they're talking all through the talks. The government has refused to contemplate bringing forward elections. So what's happened now is that the Nicaraguan opposition signed a series of agreements, many of which are quite favorable to them, but which imply a fundamental contradiction to their position of last year, namely recognition of the authorities here as the legitimately constituted government. And then now they've turned around after signing that agreement, they're now turning around and saying, oh no, we've got to bring forward elections. And where does that come from? Of course it comes from their owners in the United States, and in the United States government, in the United States elites.
I mean, this is the same stupid game that went on in Venezuela for last year's elections. You know, you had a fragmentation of the right wing prior to this a peace agreement that was brokered. If you remember when they went, they started to discuss all of this stuff, there was one section of the opposition that was boycotting. There was another section that wanted to go ahead. And they have all these talks, and they reach some sort of an agreement, and then the agreement is blown out of the water. One of the consequences is that they missed the petitioning period for people to get on the ballot, and then turn around and say, well, you know, they turn around and pretend that they're Lula, where Lula wants to run, and he's in a jail cell so they can keep him from running. They're off the ballot because they didn't sign the papers to get on the ballot, and they're saying, "Well, the dictator won't let us run."
Well, yeah, and so what you have is, you have a right wing that is non-agreement capable, have no intention of honoring any commitments that they may enter into with. For example, the government of Evo Morales in Bolivia, the government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, Daniel Ortega's government here in Nicaragua, or, for that matter, the government, the revolutionary government in Cuba. And we should actually point out that, and I don't think we have so far in our recent conversations, we should point out that Cuba has just gone through the most participatory democratic process that's happened anywhere in the hemisphere since certainly over the last few years, whereby they held something like, what was it, 130,000 public meetings in order to agree reforms to the constitution.
Yeah.
And then that went to a referendum, which was won overwhelmingly with support for the proposed changes, and the United States. Just imagine that process happening in the United States. It would never happen.
Pete, I just came from there, as you know. I spent 10 days last week and the week before in Cuba, and people are very excited about what's happening there. The place itself feels like vibrant. And the people are very enthusiastic about the future there, and even the present. And there's a certain sense of pride and accomplishment over what has already happened that is palpable, practically.
Quite rightly.
Yeah, for sure. It's been earned, obviously.
So you've got this extraordinary capacity for democratic process on the part of revolutionary forces in Latin America, and look at what they're up against. They're up against complete people who are incompetent, people who are demented, people who actually believe their own propaganda. And here in Nicaragua, the opposition continually project themselves as, you know, the majority force in the country, but poll after poll is still showing that they have under 10% support.
Right.
You know, and you get the same in Venezuela. And look at Juan Guaido, and over the last month, it's been absolutely clear that he has practically zero support.
Yep.
And as an individual, there may be people who broadly support the opposition position, but he as an individual has practically zero support. Yep. And that he's still projected by local and U.S. media as some kind of significant political force.
Well, listen,
he's a complete nobody.
Nobody. I mean, I wish I was in D.C. when his first lady was there, because I would have liked to have interviewed her to find out how things are going at home in the midst of all of this. But, you know, to sum it up, in essence, what we're talking about is a situation with tremendous promise on the one hand in terms of the development of democratic institutions and economic growth and such, you know, being essentially stifled right now by lying lunatics with guns. And that situation is going to have to change, and we can pick it up next week at that point, perhaps, because we are out of time. But I'd like to go into particularly some more detail about Cuba when we pick it up next week.
Right. Great.
Okay.
Thanks a million, Don.
Thank you very much, Tony. We'll speak with you again, and thanks for all the work you do.
Okay. And you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.